Hello.
Hello, Blogging Heads Nation. It's Heather Hurlburt, Executive Director at the National Security Network, with
Jonathan Chait, Senior Editor at the New Republic.
And today's edition is True or False? The Democratic Party has a better shot in November than the Michigan football team. Discuss.
Yeah. I think we're going to save the football part for the end, sort of as a tantalizing teaser for
okay.
the viewers.
All right. So Joe Lieberman is crazy.
Yeah.
John asserts in a recent New Republic article that we should view Lieberman's sort of move, lunge, not just to the right, but the farther part of the right, not just as sort of a strange thing, but of almost operatic weirdness.
Yeah. It's, you know, because he always has been so temperamentally moderate, even though he's had some, you know, a lot of conservative positions. But he's really turned into this shrieking, hysterical, ultra-partisan Republican figure, which when that's the thing that's so strange, and that's what I tried to write about in my column.
Well, and you very responsibly refrained from psychological speculation as to why that happened, so I
right.
was hoping that in this intimate crowd with a few thousand of your closest friends, you would...
I'll be irresponsible.
Be a little more irresponsible.
Yeah, no, I don't think it takes much to figure out he's obviously just so wounded and angered by the primary challenge of Ned Lamont. And almost all the Democrats were with him during the primary, the Democratic primary. But then when he lost the primary, you know, most of them endorsed the duly nominated Democratic candidate because they're Democrats. And Lieberman, I think is just infuriated at this, and couldn't believe that someone would run against him at all. Mm-hmm. I think that whatever tendency, right wing tendencies he had in the past have become pronounced and have metastasized into, you know, a real partisan Republican role he's taken on.
Did he really not? I mean, you sound as if he thought that the laws of politics didn't apply to him.
No, that's right. Well, I think a lot of people do. I think a lot of senators feel entitled. They feel they own their seat. They can't believe, you know, I think it's a lot the same way that the way that Clinton and McCain have reacted to Obama running against them. Who is this kid? This is my job. Why do they want to take my job? You know, it's like if it, they just think that's their role, that's who they are. It's like if someone else came to, you know, and tried to be like the husband to my wife and father to my children. You know, I wouldn't care if they were claiming to do a better job at it. I would say, what are you talking about? This is me. You can't take this from me. You know, and that's sort of how there's a real incredulity, especially when it's a less experienced and younger person. And I think that explains a lot of the reaction a lot of these people have.
So it's a sort of occupational hazard of life in the Senate.
Right, the Senate especially.
Yeah, because I have another bit of an explanation, which is that Lieberman is one of these people whose worldview really was fundamentally altered by September 11th,
mm-hmm.
And that you see, you know, these stories of sort of people who actually switched their party affiliation,
right?
And that we know that fear has a really profound effect on people, and that 9/11 was so frightening that for many people it almost functions as a surrogate for confronting your own mortality and your own death.
Right, John Junis had an article about that in the New Republic.
Yes, I'm exactly thinking of that mortality salience research that John did such a great job of putting out there. But that for people seeing, you know, people who could have been them dying in that way, it was such a personal thing.
Yeah.
That you have a lot of, one of the more interesting other rightward turns I noticed was the entire Washington Post editorial page. I sometimes feel like the entire Post editorial page sort of secretly thinks that the Pennsylvania plane was headed for them.
I think there's more going on with the Post than that. I think it predates that.
Okay, I'll buy that. The tone, and I mean a number actually there were some Times columnists too that really sort of felt the attacks very personally, I think. And I have wondered whether some of this with Lieberman is that, you know, almost something changed in his brain or his way of thinking after 9/11, and that in fact the marvelous piece you cite in the article of, you know, Lieberman saying that Democrats don't care about terrorists and then quoting Obama sort of railing on about the terrorists, you know, that it's as if Lieberman almost can't hear that.
Right. Now that's right. I mean, what, you know, for those who haven't read the column I wrote, it's, you know, he's trying to put everything through this, you know, McGovern frame, which is the central narrative of neoconservatism. Democrats, you know, and the left turned against America. They don't believe in America's goodness. They don't believe in America's power. They refuse to acknowledge that our enemies are evil. And that's clearly not true of Obama. And he says it's true of Obama, but he doesn't produce a single piece of evidence that it's true, and it's obviously not true of Obama. And for instance, I quote him saying exactly the kinds of very strident language about the evil of some of our enemies. That's exactly what, you know, Lieberman wants him to say. So that's part of it. I mean, but of course, Lieberman was a foreign policy neoconservative before September 11th. You know, he was an advocate of rogue state rollback.
Right. I mean, culturally, you could argue that Lieberman is culturally a neoconservative, I suppose.
You know, certainly in some ways. I mean, there's a lot of the neoconservative beliefs that he's always held. One of the things is he was able to reconcile those with being a Democrat. One, because, you know, he was a Democrat in good standing. Two, I think there were a lot of Democrats who agreed on Iraq, you know, in 2002 and 2003, and that consensus came apart. And my interpretation is that there were, you know, good reasons to support the war, but then it became pretty clear that the war was going badly, and that almost everyone who didn't have a real strong partisan investment in the war acknowledged that the war was going badly. And Lieberman didn't. I mean, you know, he just became right there with, and he, you know, and he, you know, the phrase I use is spider hole of denial.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's been saying all along the war's been going great and we must fight on, and you know, he never ever questioned it and began ascribing the worst of motives to anyone who thought differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's another fascinating piece of social science research that this calls to mind, mm-hmm. which was some work that Stephen Cull did in 2004, interviewing and polling people who had already decided for sure in September to support Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And he found that those folks, despite sort of already knowing in September for sure they were going to vote for Bush, were thought that the Kyoto Protocol and the International Criminal Court were great ideas, and moreover, they thought that Bush thought that too.
Hmm.
And so Cull sort of asked himself, well, how can this be that people are carrying around such a large amount of cognitive dissonance in their heads? And his conclusion was that there was a chunk of the electorate that that needed so badly to feel safe and needed to feel that Bush was keeping them safe. And
right.
In fact, there's been subsequent research on sort of why Americans have the party, the associations with political parties they do on national security that actually NSN, my employer, is funding.
Mm-hmm.
That people have maybe more deeply than they do on domestic issues, and I'd be curious how you think this plays out on the economy. People are really deeply invested in believing that basically the government is handling military and foreign affairs okay.
Right.
That there's a much greater kind of assumption of competence, although I'm not sure there's much of an assumption of competence anywhere anymore, but
yeah.
Apparently people do still really have an investment in believing that that things are going the right way. And you can kind of, you know, Lieberman, who's always been, as you said, such a sort of, you know, was such an amiable person and really believed profoundly in bipartisanship, just really needing to believe that this was the right thing, and that combining with no longer it, for the reasons you said, feeling very at home with the party and feeling betrayed by the party, that the two things just kind of reacted with each other to push him even further.
Yeah, no, I that certainly could play into it. You know, but remember, you know, even in 2004, Lieberman was running as a Democrat. He was running for president as a Democrat.
That's right.
So then that was 3 years after September 11th.
Mm-hmm.
Two and a half, 3 years after September 11th. So, you know, I mean, I think that the change in him to a partisan Republican figure seems to be connected to his to 2006 and his.
Right.
And his
so you think he's taking real sort of joy or satisfaction at some level in being a partisan Republican?
I do, and you know, and I also think that, and I know from experience, when you're under attack from people on the left, the what your brain tells you you want to do is switch sides. Is say, I'll show them. I'll be a Republican, you know, screw those guys. That, like, just like that thought floats into your head and it, like, gives you a feeling of incredible satisfaction. And I think, you know, you don't have to be a very big person to to be able to say, no, I'm not going to let my enemies define me. You know, even if they say I'm not a liberal, I know I am. But maybe Joe Lieberman isn't a big enough person.
My feeling on that is always, no, I'm not going to let you take my identity away from me. It's interesting.
Right.
When I get that same kind of, oh, you know, you're nothing but a neocon warmonger, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Right. I mean, you know, do you get that same very tempting feeling to say, you know, I'll show them? I mean, I think I
have never been tempted.
Yeah.
No, I mean, you know, I get.
And to be clear, I've never come close to acting on it. It's just like it's a fleeting thing that comes in your mind, and it's just, you know, it's like this the self-pitying thing that's like it's the ultimate revenge.
No, I think my self-pitying response is kind of, well, gee, I'd like to be Stalin and expel all of you from the party.
So there you go.
But I think you make a fair point about human nature.
So why don't you tell us how you think the national security debate's gonna play out in the campaign?
Well, I mean McCain has telegraphed very clearly what the strategy is, which is to simultaneously hit Obama very hard from the right on exactly these issues that raise fear and mortality salience. So, you know, on terrorism, on the military, on to make Iran as much of an issue as he possibly can, to make Iraq as much of an issue as he possibly can, while at the same time trying to steal Obama's support on the center left by giving these speeches. And there's a real consistent pattern now in the McCain foreign policy speeches that you start out with some kind of mention of World War II, the Holocaust, Vietnam, that reminds you that, you know, supposedly we live in dangerous times and need a strong hand, except, of course, we don't live during World War II or the Holocaust or Vietnam. So if you really stop and think about it, it's not clear how relevant that is, but it puts the listener in a certain mind frame. Mm-hmm. Then he sort of tells you the way that he's going to be tough and Obama isn't going to be tough enough. And then he puts in a bunch of sort of dog whistles for liberals and the mainstream media, you know, that sort of we should reduce nuclear weapons, we should, and, you know, that sound better than they actually are when you go back and read the text. Mm-hmm. So that saying, you know, look again at the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, for example, well, it's been out there. Either you ratify it or you don't ratify it. You don't look at it again. You know, either you reduce the number of warheads or you don't. You don't conduct yet another review of how many we can reduce subject to, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. You know, that means you could do it, you cannot do it. You've left yourself, you know, an exit hole big enough to drive the quote-unquote Straight Talk Express through. And then you follow that up with a series of dog whistles to the right, basically sort of saying reassuringly, but don't worry, we're going to stay in Iraq for a long time. We're not particularly interested in moving forward the Middle East peace process. I'm just trying to think. You know, we're not going to negotiate with Iran until they fulfill all of our conditions first. So that you create this speech where, first of all, you scare that portion of your audience that sort of wants to be scared and then reassured by you.
Yeah.
You point out to the mainstream media how wonderfully bipartisan and liberal and not George Bush you are, and then he reassures his base that, you know, really he's with them on all of their particular litmus tests.
Yeah.
And so that to me is the sort of simple strategy, and he's done it over and over, and somewhat to my chagrin, it seems to be working.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hesitating because, number one, I shouldn't be so negative. Number two, Obama's only now just getting going. And number three, what I don't know is whether he's being, in fact, too clever, and all the World War II and Holocaust scary references work on the media, but they don't necessarily work on the general public. And I wonder whether it's an approach that's actually going to be too sophisticated to ultimately work.
That's interesting. You know, my What I've noticed is the way he goes after Obama with his little sound bites, and what I've noticed is that he always tries to frame it as a matter of knowledge that Barack Obama doesn't understand, doesn't get, that he's trying to portray him as, you know, as a total naive, someone who literally, you know, wouldn't have the faintest idea how to start, you know, acting as commander-in-chief. And I actually think that's a terrible plan because Obama actually knows plenty about foreign policy. I think factually,
yeah, and McCain has shown himself to be, I mean, it's a risky plan because McCain has shown himself to be a little short on core knowledge about sort of the difference between a Sunni and a Shiite.
Right.
You know, who is with us and who isn't with us, which things are happening in Iraq and which things are happening in Afghanistan.
Right.
Which, by the way, is a whole other interesting psychological question in that I have trouble believing he doesn't really know those things, although perhaps he doesn't.
Right.
You know, he's definitely going in that direction because the hesitation that people have about Obama is the inexperience, and he thinks it's a way to play that up. But I think there's a fairly good... He has to be darn sure he doesn't make any gaffes himself if that's the direction he's going to go.
That's right. And the other thing is, and I think I've said this before on Blogging Heads, but so I apologize for those, you know, hardcore viewers, but I think he's setting himself up for a big fall. Because in the debates, I think, you know, Obama is going to show that he knows plenty about the world and can speak with, you know, intelligently about these issues. And I think, you know, McCain is setting the bar so low that Obama's going to clear it.
Well, I tell you, what is tricky about showing that you know a lot about the world, if you go back and look at the 2000 foreign policy debate between Al Gore and George W. Bush, and progressives really looked forward to that one because everybody thought, oh, George W. Bush is, you know, he will make foolish mistakes and everyone will see how smart Al Gore is,
right,
and that will be the end of that. And I watched that debate that night with a bunch of White House colleagues, and we all felt in the moment like Gore had clearly won that debate, that he clearly looked smarter and so on. And if you go back and look at it several years later, I mean, which I don't recommend, it's kind of depressing.
Yeah.
But how it comes off, you know, Gore, and this is so hard on national security issues in particular, that it's so difficult to come across as knowledgeable without coming across as snotty and elitist.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, even the Sunni Shiite thing, as I was saying it, I realized the whole trick is to convey the idea that we're not criticizing you, the American people, for being unable to keep these things straight, but the whole point is you should have leaders who can keep them straight for you because that is their job after
right.
all. And you should not have leaders who get you into wars in places without understanding the basic dynamics there.
Yeah.
So I do think, you know, it's an opportunity for Obama, but it's also a real risk that very smart, talented Democrats have floundered on before. And of course, John Kerry had the same problem. But sometimes, especially in national security, knowing too much is a bit of a handicap.
No, that's right. I mean, Obama's great advantage here is that he doesn't have to win by showing he's smarter and more knowledgeable the way Gore. He doesn't have to disqualify his opponent. He merely has to clear the bar. He merely has to show that he can go toe-to-toe, and I think he'll do it.
Right, but figuring out how to clear the bar without reinforcing people's impressions of you that you're a funny sort of Harvard-educated elitist who's not one of us is a particular challenge that national security poses in the electoral environment.
Yeah.
I mean, I should ask you the same question about economic issues, actually. How do you talk? I mean, okay, granted, everybody sort of gets that McCain doesn't know the first thing about the economy, but
right.
there's a risk, again, that he sort of turns that to his advantage. And how do you talk intelligently about what the heck we can do about the economy and the gas prices without sounding too much like a PhD economist?
I mean, I think it's pretty simple. I mean, you tie McCain to Bush, and I think that's correct. They're trying to wriggle out of it. You know, the McCain line is to say, and I wrote, this was my previous column, but I'll summarize it quickly, is to say, we're nothing like Bush because, yeah, you know, yes, we agree with the tax cuts, but we deplore all the big spending, and that's where we're gonna you know, depart from Bush. But I point out that's exactly Bush's position, which is that the tax cuts were great, but, boy, I deplore all this spending, and we've really got to do something about it. It's the exact same thing. You know, and so you just, I mean, all, you know, except that he wants even more tax cuts that are even more tilted to the rich than Bush has. That's his economic program. It's, and you know, what he's trying to hit back on Obama is say big government, big spending, big taxing, 1970s Jimmy Carter. You know, and this was the exchange the other day. You know, McCain said he says I'm trying to run for George Bush's third term, but I think he's running for Jimmy Carter's second. Well, that's a trade that Barack Obama will take because yes. People are much more angry at George W. Bush right now than at Jimmy Carter.
Yeah, I thought, by the way, that was a major and perhaps somewhat underappreciated triumph of the progressive movement that McCain went out and gave a speech in which he said over and over and over, "I am not George W. Bush's third term."
Yeah.
And that for all the people who have wrung their hands over the years about progressives not figuring out how to attack and so on and so on, when you get to the point going out and saying, "I am not," and then repeating your attack, you've had a good week. And
that's
that
true.
Surprised me because, you know, I thought their message machine was smarter than that.
But. Yeah, no, I mean, economically, he's basically thrown most of his dissenting positions overboard. And the tax cuts really are... They've been the central domestic battleground of American politics. I mean, that's where the parties fight over about the basic question of who gets what. And the Republican answer to the question of who gets what is, we want basically the top 1 or 2% to get as much as they can, instead of other people getting other things. And so that's been the main battleground. And he was completely against the Republican position, and now he's completely for it.
Now, can you walk me through quickly his evolution on that set of issues? Because I don't know enough about it, and then I'll do the same on national security, where I could make a rather similar critique, I think.
Okay, we're back.
We're back, and you were just explaining to me John McCain's evolution away from economic sanity.
It's not really an evolution. I mean, you know, so basically when he ran for president, he started taking a Democratic position on taxes, essentially. He was saying we should save the surplus. We shouldn't give it to the tax cuts. And George W. Bush's tax plan, you know, gives most of the benefits to people at the very top, and that's morally wrong, and we should save it. That was the Democratic position, basically. He voted against the Bush tax cuts in 2001. He voted against the 2003 tax cuts. And then, basically, in 2004, he decided, you know, I think there was a lot of talk about running for president as an independent at some point. And I think in 2004, and remember there was all the talk about him being with John Kerry.
Oh, right.
He had like 7 conversations with John Kerry about being vice president, which he now basically refuses to ever discuss.
He had 7? I did not realize that.
Yeah, reportedly 7 conversations. And they say, well, there was nothing to talk about. I'm a Republican, he's a Democrat. We said goodbye, but it's hard to imagine how it took 7 conversations to establish that. Yeah, and they just and remember he blew up at, I think it was Elizabeth Buemiller, the New York Times reporter, when she asked him about this. He won't talk about what went on in those conversations at all. And obviously Kerry, I think, is being a mensch and it won't betray McCain's confidence. He won't talk about it either. And of course in 2001 there was serious talks about McCain splitting the Republican Party and caucusing with the Democrats as well. So anyway, 2004, after the Kerry episode, he decided he was going whole hog, Republican primary, Republican going to run in 2008. And so he basically just flip-flopped completely on the Bush tax cuts, embraced them, said he would make them permanent. And, you know, to reassure the right, because, you know, as I've written in my book, The Big Con, available at bookstores everywhere. It's the economic right that really pulls the strings in the Republican Party, and that's the one group that you absolutely cannot cross. He's supported $300 billion a year in additional tax cuts, almost all of them going to the rich, to sort of reassure people that he's not going to be backsliding. So that's his position now. There was no evolution.
Yeah.
So,
well, the interesting thing, I'm trying to think whether there's a relevant comparison on the national security piece, because the fascinating thing about McCain on national security is that he, and my colleague Alon Goldenberg wrote about this in the New Republic a few weeks ago, that he's never had, when you actually go back and look at the record, it's a little bit all over the place, that there's a strong belief in the efficacy of military power, but not always a consistent desire to apply it.
Yeah.
There's an interest in... Sometimes there's an interest in negotiating with our enemies, viz. Vietnam, for example,
right.
Where, you know, he was one of the leaders in restoring relations, and sometimes
right.
there's not. That, you know, he was very supportive of the Clinton administration on some aspects of the Balkan Wars and very unsupportive on others. And it's It's just, it's very hard to draw a picture of sort of a coherent McCain ideology on national security. And when you, as I say, when you look at the speeches and the foreign affairs article, it's similarly hard to pull, you know, when he says he's a realistic idealist or whichever version of that cliche he uses,
yeah.
You know, I mean, he means it in a way of kind of there are elements of both floating around in there and you, they don't always add up.
Right. 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 No, yeah, he's actually, and John Trudis wrote, you know, I'm citing him again, wrote a piece about his, the evolution of McCain's foreign policy views for us. You know, he wasn't always this hardcore neocon that he's coming across as now, which, you know, it's kind of encouraging. He does talk to the sort of realist wing, which in the Republican Party, which is not my favorite group of people in the world, but it is nice that he's got different people with dissenting views that he listens to.
Although there's interesting gossip about members of the realist wing of the party actually not wanting to be embraced by him because of some of the positions he's taken.
Huh.
And so finding themselves, and I think, you know, you see different members of the party making different choices, and some people that I think are very smart, sane realists are working closely with him. His new foreign policy advisor is someone I respect very much, but other people that I also respect very much in the community kind of skulking around and trying to figure out ways, you know, to avoid returning phone calls from the campaign. Because they think some of the positions are so out there. And, you know, the underlying, my underlying view of all, everything that he has said on national security is much of it is simply not possible as long as you insist on keeping 150,000 troops in Iraq for the undefined future.
Forever. Yeah.
And that you just, you're not being honest with the American people, but maybe more important, you're not being honest with yourself. If you sort of imagine that you can take these steps that will restore the U.S. image in the world and restore functional multilateralism, yet you insist on doing the thing that, A, has enraged the world, and, B, that the world sees as counterproductive. I mean, and in a similar way, just one other little thing, I have to mention that people loved the nonproliferation speech so much, but who does our partner in nonproliferation have to be? Russia. If your other initiative with regard to Russia is to throw them out of the G8, the most, you know, sort of prestigious, one of the most prestigious global bodies that they've managed to get into since the collapse of the Soviet Union, and you say, oh, I'm going to throw you out, but then I'm going to negotiate arms control reductions with you. Well, that's just not logical.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't proceed from a comprehensive worldview that actually sort of looks at the world the way it is, and,
right.
and as such, it, you know, it's disqualified from the realist label in my
right.
mind.
That's interesting, and we, you know, I think we're probably near the end, and so we should probably get to the promised Michigan football discussion that our
viewers
are
waiting for. Ah, yes, and now we reach the real realist idealist part.
Right.
How is the new coach, and is there any hope of this being anything other than a god awful rebuilding year?
I think there is, and I'm not a Michigan football Pollyanna.
You're the idealist in the group on that.
I have to say, I thought the team would be overrated in 2007. I was sure the team would be way overrated in 2005. So I'm not some wild Pollyanna. I think the team is going to be underrated this year. Rich Rodriguez is an unbelievable coach with an incredible record. I don't want to go on too long because I know nobody cares, probably not even including you. But since you started this, you know, I recently saw a statistic of the top five recruiting rankings, schools in recruiting and performance of the past 5 years. And basically the top five performance schools, you had four schools that were also the top five recruiting schools. And the fifth was West Virginia, which is, of course, was his team.
Yeah.
So basically, every other program that's had a top record has great, great athletes except for his. So he's able to take, you know, very, very average talent and turn an unbelievable product in the field out of it. So his record of doing that is pretty much unmatched.
So you and I will reunite and do another one of these at some point in the fall, and we will compare how we are doing on international politics, the economy, and football.
Sounds good.
Great talking to you.
Thanks, Heather.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.